The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. James Blend is producing, Clark Hilton engineering, Dan Rice, well, he's given up his office. Today we're going to talk with John Fortmeyer. We'll catch up with him to find out the latest with regard to Christian News Northwest. How that is faring in the online edition and what the future looks like as the pandemic shelter-in-place order remains in place. We'll also hear a classic interview with Dr. Andy Walsh, the book Faith Across the Multiverse, Parables from Modern Science. That's coming up later this hour as well. And, of course, we'll wind our way through the latest news regarding COVID-19 and other issues as they relate to what's going on across the country. Well, we learned earlier today that SpaceX and NASA, that was set for an historic astronaut launch today, has been scrapped but rescheduled for Saturday at 12:22 Pacific time. No launch today. Apparently, weather was at the core of that issue. Thunderstorms had threatened to delay the launch earlier today as two astronauts aboard SpaceX rocket waited for liftoff on this historic-making flight. In fact, they were on the rocket at the time it was scrapped. It's seen as a giant leap forward for the business of commercial space travel. The flight would mark the first time a private company sent humans into orbit. It would also be the first time in nearly a decade that the United States launched astronauts into orbit from U.S. soil. Ever since the space shuttle was retired in 2011, NASA has relied on Russian spaceships launched from Kazakhstan to take U.S. astronauts to and from the space station. But that has, as I've mentioned, been scrapped until Saturday, weather permitting. So that's kind of the top news story of the day. In other news, House Republicans filed a lawsuit Tuesday against Speaker Nancy Pelosi, seeking to block a system of proxy voting put in place during the coronavirus pandemic on the grounds that it is unconstitutional. The speaker's plan would allow House members to vote on another person's behalf if they are not able to be physically present at the Capitol. It's an unprecedented exception for an unparalleled health crisis. At least 59 Democrats have submitted letters to the House clerk's office to authorize their vote to be cast by proxy. Meanwhile, GOP lawmakers have said that they will be in the Capitol to cast their votes. Not a single Republican supported the measure as it passed earlier this month, arguing the Constitution requires a quorum or a majority of lawmakers to be physically present in order to vote on a measure, thus concluding the proxy system is unconstitutional. Republicans also worry the system would concentrate too much power in the hands of only a few members. Well, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, he called the new voting rules a dereliction of duty as elected officials and argued a small number of members dictating the business of the whole House while the people's voice is diluted would set a dangerous precedent. And chaos broke out in Minneapolis on Tuesday night as protesters took to the streets to demand action after the death of a black man in police custody a day earlier. George Floyd, 46, died Monday night, and video later emerged showing the man on the ground with a police officer pressing his knee against his Floyd's neck while he was handcuffed for at least 5 minutes. Officers had responded to a call from a grocery store that claimed Floyd had allegedly tried to make purchases with a forged check. Floyd's death sparked new tensions between police and the black community. Police on Tuesday night, they fired rubber bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades on some protesters. The protest started peacefully, but the situation deteriorated, and some demonstrators were seen breaking windows of police cars and hurling rocks. We're here to let you know that this cannot and will not be tolerated. There will be severe consequence if they continue to kill us. This will not go on another day, one protester said, according to local media. The officers involved have been fired, but charges have not yet been issued for the death of this man in their custody. Well, as I mentioned, SpaceX was making its final preparations today. Demo 2 mission to launch NASA astronauts from the U.S. soil for the first time since 2011. A SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and Crew Dragon spacecraft would transport these astronauts, Doug Hurley and Ben Behnken, to the International Space Station on the historic mission. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said he texted the two astronauts on Monday and told them, "If you want me to stop this thing for any reason, say so. I will stop it in a heartbeat if you want me to." They both came back and they said, "We're go for launch." Now, that has since been postponed, and we're expecting that will happen on Saturday at about 12:21 Pacific time. Well, Democrats are stressed as the economy threatens to recover, which is sort of a peculiar position to be in, but it is an election year, so peculiar is the word of the next several months. Obama economist Jason Furman told Democrats the economy could see the best economic data in the history of this country. That's a quote. You'd think that would be viewed favorably by all, but from the story, Furman's counterintuitive pitch has caused some Democrats, especially Obama alumni around Washington, to panic. "This is my big worry," said former Obama White House official, who's still close to the former president. Asked about the level of concern among top party officials, he said, "It's high, 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 high." Again, that's a quote. "People are committing suicide over this, and Democrats are worried it will stop." Now, again, it's so peculiar. You're lamenting the fact that the economy might come rushing back. The Wall Street Journal points out that Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats know what they want: keep the economy locked down for as long as the virus exists, and as appropriate, as much taxpayer money as possible to replace the lost private incomes. Mrs. Pelosi's House bill promises another $3 trillion for her various constituencies on top of the $2.7 trillion or so Congress has already spent on the pandemic. The goal is income redistribution, not economic growth. Again, from the Wall Street Journal. Well, MSNBC mocked a man during a story who was not wearing a mask. The MSNBC man on the street complained that people aren't wearing masks and focused on one in particular, who then pointed out live on the air that half of the MSNBC television crew weren't wearing masks either. Same moment from the POV of the guy who busted them was a rather laughable moment. Meanwhile, as the total U.S. death toll tops 100,000, the daily deaths are the lowest since March. The Department of Justice has dropped the investigation into three U.S. senators for questionable stock trades. But Senator Burr is still under investigation from Kelly Loeffler. Today's clear exoneration affirms what I've said all along. I did nothing wrong. This was a politically motivated attack promoted by the fake news media, she said in response to the now dropped charges. And she added her political opponents, "I'm continuing to focus my full attention on results for Georgia." Nikki Haley points out, happy to see vindication for Kelly Loeffler. She handled the inquiry with complete transparency, proud of how she continues to serve the people of Georgia honorably. Well, Mark Thiessen says it's time to end the lockdown, and he argues in a piece in the Washington Post, "The objective of the lockdown was never to stop every American from getting COVID-19, which is impossible. It was to buy time to learn about the virus and prevent our healthcare system from being overwhelmed. We've accomplished those goals." Again, time to end the lockdown, he argues. The California governor has agreed to allow churches to meet at 25% capacity, the Daily Caller reports. But then came this: the pace at which the state has made these modifications is concerning. Santa Clara Public Health Officer Sarah Cody told the County Board of Supervisors at their Tuesday afternoon meeting, noting that other states have exercised more caution, including New Jersey, which limited such gatherings to 25 people, and New York, where no more than 10 people are allowed. Cody stressed that the board at least has a full incubation period of 14 days and preferably 21 is needed to effectively gauge the impact of each step of the reopening process. And Victor Davis Hanson points out in a very stunning piece, Emeritus Barack Obama now and then ventures out to go through the motions of an enfeebled defense for what is becoming an increasingly discredited administration. But his heart is not in it. His mind is elsewhere. His cause is no longer social activism and community organizing, if it ever was, but lucre and the perceived well-earned good life. The arc of his moralizing universe is long, but for the anointed like him, it apparently bends toward the just deserts of riches and material bounty. Sort of an indictment on the former president's exit from the political world. We're going to take a break. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back in a few moments, so stay with us.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon. Later in the show, we're going to talk with John Fortmeyer. He's the publisher of Christian News Northwest. We'll talk about the June issue, which once again is online. But what does that mean for the paper moving forward? John Fortmeyer will join us in the second hour of today's program. Coming up in the next couple of segments, we'll talk with Andy Walsh. Dr. Walsh is the author of Faith Across the Multiverse, Parables from Modern Science. That classic interview will air in just a few minutes, so hope you'll stay with us. Amy Swearer, who's been an activist in the Me Too movement, says, "Believe women meant what we thought it meant. We're being gaslighted," she says, "and we have the receipts to prove it." And then she does just that. She proves it. Well, young female athletes in Idaho have stood up to the ACLU. The ACLU wants males to be able to compete against females, and that battle continues, as we all well know. Well, U.S. equity markets surged to their best levels in months as states continue to reopen and traders returned to the New York Stock Exchange for the first time since shutting down on March the 23rd to slow the spread of COVID-19. That was on Tuesday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rallied more than 600 points on that day, or 2.45% in the opening minutes of trading, while the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ Composite were higher by 2.20% and 1.84% respectively. At least five states are taking steps to ease lockdowns on Tuesday, with Michigan allowing retail businesses to open by appointment and Arkansas letting freestanding bars unlock their doors. This after a new study out of Singapore suggests COVID-19 patients are not infectious 11 days after getting sick. In support of their findings, researchers noted that a separate study out of Germany found the degree of viral shedding was very high in the first week of symptoms. Meanwhile, there's some new optimism in the treatment of coronavirus. The results from a National Institutes of Health clinic trial support the use of the antiviral drug remdesivir in treating coronavirus after data pointed to improved recovery time for hospitalized COVID-19 patients. Though remdesivir has not received formal approval, hospitals nationwide have administered the drug to some critically ill coronavirus patients after a federal shipment was delivered earlier this month. And farmers in North Carolina are being forced to euthanize 1.5 million chickens following outbreaks of the novel coronavirus at meat processing plants across the state, an official has revealed, and a mysterious inflammatory syndrome tied to COVID-19 that's been reported in children is now also turning up in young adults in their early 20s, according to new reports. And there are several other developments worth mentioning. Some Democrats reportedly worry that an explosive economic recovery in the fall could revive the president's lagging political fortunes and boost his chance of reelection. Former Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, in an interview with Fox and Friends on Tuesday, alleged that Democrats are willing to crush the economy if it leads to a Trump defeat in November. And Congress will have to give serious consideration to an additional financial package aimed at helping struggling transportation companies and mass transit systems. Former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood said yesterday. Another potential COVID-19 vaccine candidate has started clinical trials as biotech company Novavax began to inject volunteers in Australia this week. And the echoes of 9/11 ring louder than ever for Ed Donnelly amid the coronavirus pandemic. Donnelly is the brother of fallen New York firefighter Lieutenant Kevin Donnelly, and he compares the bravery of today's coronavirus frontline responders to those on 9/11. Mitch Daniels, the former Republican governor of Indiana and current president of Purdue University, wrote in a Washington Post op-ed on Tuesday morning that failing to reopen the university for students this fall would be an unacceptable breach of duty. We'll see what happens there. Well, the genetic code found in sewage sludge could be a leading indicator of COVID-19 outbreaks. Anticipating the presence of the virus by 7 days and hospital admissions by 3 days, a new study from researchers at Yale University says. I wouldn't want to engage in that study, but nonetheless, there are those who are willing to do so. They're appreciated. The research, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, determined that concentrations of SARS-CoV-2 RNA in sewage sludge from the New Haven, Connecticut wastewater treatment facility could be used to model the number of COVID-19 cases in the area. Meanwhile, in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo handling the coronavirus outbreak in nursing homes is falling under further scrutiny. Cuomo, who signed legislation granting hospital and nursing home executives immunity from lawsuits related to the novel coronavirus last month, previously received a big money boost from a powerful healthcare industry group, according to a new report. The New York governor is set to meet with President Trump on Wednesday in D.C. The president still wants a 4th of July celebration to take place in the nation's capital, despite pleas from Democratic lawmakers to cancel it due to the coronavirus pandemic. The White House announced that the event will still was still on after members of the House and Senate from Virginia, Maryland, and D.C., led by Representative Don Beyer, asked the administration to immediately suspend any plan of such an event in a letter to the Defense Secretary Mark Esper and Secretary of the Interior David Bernhard. Republicans on the House Oversight Committee sent a letter to Committee Chairman Representative Carolyn Maloney on Wednesday, threatening to boycott briefings held by the committee during the coronavirus pandemic. The letter says the briefings harm minority rights and do not comply with the framework for remote business set up by the House. Republicans in their letter also panned the briefings as quasi-hearings and fake hearings. Well, the majority of small businesses in the U.S. are optimistic about reopening amid the coronavirus pandemic, according to a new study. Nearly three-quarters of businesses, or 74%, expect to return to business as usual within 6 months of coronavirus restrictions being lifted, and the Connected Commerce Council said on Wednesday. That may be encouraging. And almost half of American adults delayed or skipped medical care amid the coronavirus pandemic, according to data released on Wednesday by the Kaiser Family Foundation Health Tracking Poll. Of the 48% of adults who skipped medical care, 11% reported a worsening in their or family member's condition, according to the data. And several other developments. A potential coronavirus vaccine developed in China appeared safe and able to generate an immune response after an early trial in more than 100 people, according to a new study. The vaccine, called Ad5-nCoV, is being developed by the Chinese company CanSino Biologics and was one of the first coronavirus vaccines to enter early human trials back in March. Officials for Walt Disney World Resort have announced July 11th as a tentative reopen date for select areas of the Florida theme park. Masks will be required. New technology can detect an antivirus antibody in just 20 minutes, according to researchers in Japan. If a suitable reagent is developed, they say that the tech could be used to detect antibodies against SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. And hundreds of salons in New Jersey plan to reopen on the 1st of June, despite the governor's executive order, because their businesses are at a breaking point, salon owners said. In national interviews earlier in the day, Los Angeles officials, fed up with locals tossing their unwanted masks and gloves on the ground during the coronavirus outbreak, reportedly are asking the city's Bureau of Sanitation and Attorney's Office to find new ways to crack down on offenders, ranging from increased penalties to expanded enforcement. So don't throw your masks to the ground, they're saying. Well, on this day in history, 1995, actor Christopher Reeve, best known for his portrayal as Superman, is left paralyzed after he is thrown from his horse during a jumping event in Charlottesville, Virginia. On this day in history, 1931, two Swiss balloonists become the first humans to reach the stratosphere, rising 53,171 feet. Did I mention they were in a balloon, or at least on one? 1933, Walt Disney's Academy Award-winning animated short, The Three Little Pigs, is first released. On this day in history, 1941, the British Royal Navy sinks the German battleship Bismarck off France with a loss of 2,000 lives. 3 days after the Bismarck sank the HMS Hood with a loss of more than 1,400 lives. Amid rising world tensions, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt proclaims an unlimited national emergency during a radio address from the White House. And a UN tribunal indicts Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic for crimes against humanity, all on this day in history. Coming up, we're going to hear a classic interview with Andy Walsh. Dr. Walsh is the author of Faith Across the Multiverse, Parables from Modern Science. And we'll get to that in a few moments, but I do want to mention that this Friday, a global live stream memorial service is going to honor the life of Christian evangelist and apologist Ravi Zacharias, who died on May the 19th, after a brief battle with cancer. He launched a global team of nearly 100 Christian scholars and authors who continue to speak, resource, and train, and address the questions of millions around the world. We hope you'll join us for the celebration of Ravi's life and the legacy live stream on YouTube and Facebook at Ravi Zacharias International Ministries this Friday, May the 29th at 8 o'clock a.m. Hey, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Up next, Faith Across the Multiverse.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
My next guest says that science can help us know God. And while we know the heavens declare the glory of God, few people actually give thought to just how science and the Bible intertwine. Even the Apostle Paul says God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen. My next guest, Dr. Andy Walsh, holds a PhD in molecular biology and immunology, and is the author of Faith Across the Multiverse, Parables of Modern Science. He looks at many of the same questions biblical characters ask that are relevant to today. Solomon, for example, wondered why there is so much evil in the world. Elijah suggests an empirical test to prove God is real. Gideon begged for a sign from God, and it goes on and on from there. Well, it's a fascinating book for people who want to think deeply and see how science reveals, as Scripture suggests, the glory of God. Dr. Andy Walsh completed his postdoctoral fellowship at Carnegie Mellon University in computational biology. He earned his PhD in molecular biology and immunology from Bloomberg School of Public Health at St. Johns Hopkins, or rather at Johns Hopkins University. He serves as a science writer for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's Emerging Scholars blog, and his writing can be found on the Pathos Network and in the Behemoth, the Christianity Today publication. Today he joins us to talk about his book, Faith Across the Multiverse, Parables from Modern Science. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, learning a little bit about your background explains perhaps why you undertook this subject, but maybe we can begin there. What inspired you to take on the subject of how faith and the multiverse can help us better understand who God is over several different disciplines?
Sure. So, you know, I've always been interested in science, and I've been a part of the church for most of my life, so been two pretty constant themes. But it was in grad school, participating in Bible study through InterVarsity, where I came across the idea that something I had just learned in a math class about probability theory might help us to understand the passage in the Bible that we were talking about in our Bible study, thinking about the return of Jesus and how likely it is to happen at any given moment. And when I brought up this idea from probability theory, another math student in the class, or in the Bible study group, rather, said, "Oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me too." And so we kind of got talking about how, you know, the thing that we've been studying helped us to understand a question about the Bible that had never really made sense to us before.
Hmm.
And so after that kind of got me excited and interested, and I started paying attention a little bit more to other ways in which the things that I was learning from science, the language that I was learning from science, and those concepts behind it, could help me to think about what I was reading in the Bible a little bit differently.
Now, when you mentioned mathematics, I'm guessing half the people in our listening audience winced just a bit. It can be intimidating and overwhelming because we think about being in middle school and high school and how difficult mathematics may have been. Tell us how this book can relate to the average follower of Jesus and helping us better understand. First of all, have perhaps a higher regard for the role that science can play in helping us understand who God is, but also that we can grasp some of the concepts that you focus on in your book, Faith Across the Multiverse.
Sure. So you're right. A lot of people have anxiety about math, and I think a lot of that stems from the fact that our brains aren't naturally wired to do arithmetic very easily. So the hard computations, lots of multiplication, long division, all of that isn't something that, you know, comes naturally to us. You have to learn through a lot of hard practice, and for some folks it may never come to be particularly fluid. But that's not really what we're talking about mm-hmm. in the book. The book doesn't require anybody to actually do any long division or do any kind of computation. Instead, we're talking about ideas from math and how those ideas and the language that we use to talk about those ideas from math can help us to talk about theology. So things like the butterfly effect from chaos theory in mathematics, which is something that I think a lot of people might have encountered, may not even realize that it's something from a math discipline. But this idea that, you know, if a butterfly flaps its wings in one part of the world, it changes whether or not it's going to rain in another part of the world. and that the math that goes along with that is something that I developed as a way to talk about God's grace. And so things like that where, again, it's concepts rather than asking people to do any kind of computation mm-hmm. or calculation.
Now, the other thing I want to ask you about early on is this notion of science. In the 20th century, science became the enemy of religion, for lack of a better word, for the sake of our discussion. And so a lot of people just assume anything that falls in the category of science is a natural enemy of faith. What you are suggesting in the book, however, is that science has helped you think more clearly about who God is, and you help your readers to recognize the value of what he has created and left for us, to better understand him as well.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a popular concept of how science and religion or Christianity have been getting along in the 20th and 21st century. In fact, there's a long history of faithful Christian believers in a variety of sciences.
Absolutely.
All through the 20th and 21st century. And so, you know, there have always been plenty of people who have seen the two things to go together. And my hope is just that this might bring some of the discipline of science, the language of science that is familiar to the scientists and the folks who have studied in those areas, to be a little more familiar to everybody else through connecting it to the Bible and also through connecting it to popular stories as well.
Now, Faith Across the Multiverse looks at God from four distinct categories. The language of mathematics, we've already mentioned, but also the language of physics, the language of biology, and the language of computer science. Talk to us a little bit about your desire to introduce readers to God and how science in these four disciplines in particular can help us do that.
Sure. So I chose those particular parts of science mostly because they were the ones I was most familiar with and most comfortable talking about. And I think that they can help us explore different features of God and our Christian beliefs. So in math, I talk a little bit about some of the more abstract ideas, like what is the nature of God and what is the nature of God's grace, and so forth. And then in the section on physics, we talk about Jesus, who is the physical incarnation of God as a human. And so now we're starting to take some of those abstract ideas from the math and putting them in context of the real physical world and how those two things relate. And all of that comes to a head in the person of Jesus in Scripture. So we talk about who Jesus is, how we relate to him, and what his nature is as the incarnation of God in human form. And then we move into biology. Biology is all about how organisms function and how all their various parts work together. And so that's a section that I use to explore how the church can function and how the different parts of the church, the different people in the church, can fully realize their mission and their calling as the body of Christ. And then the computer science section, talk about, so computer science is a lot about taking tasks, figuring how to do something, how to do it well and do it repeatedly. And so taking some ideas from computer science and talking about, okay, so how is it that we are to live our lives? What are we practically meant to do as we seek to follow after Jesus?
Now, you write that your belief in God is informed by historical corroboration of the Bible. You've given us four scientific disciplines. Can you give us an example of how historical corroboration of the Bible has helped your belief in God and perhaps a better understanding of who he is?
All right. So, there's various, validations of different parts of the gospel, different elements, historical events that are recorded there in the life of Jesus that we found other archaeological evidence for or documentary evidence for. Actually, one of the things that I think is most interesting for folks who maybe are focused on science and things that they can observe in the moment is just the historical reality that the Christian church meets to worship on Sundays and yet has this historical tradition coming out of the Jewish religious tradition that meets to worship on Saturdays. And how do we explain that? Well, one way that we explain that in the Christian tradition is that people had an encounter with the man of Jesus, that he died and that he rose again, and that we celebrate that resurrection by observing the Sabbath on Sunday. And so that's just a historical fact that we can observe in the present day. I go to church on Sunday. Lots of other folks go to church on Sunday. Well, how do we explain that fact of the world that we currently live in? And the story of the Bible helps to corroborate that or that explain that fact that we see today.
We're talking about the book Faith Across the Multiverse, Parables from Modern Science, written by Dr. Andy Walsh. It really is a fascinating look at four disciplines in science that, as you described earlier, you're most familiar with: the language of mathematics, the language of physics, the language of biology, and the language of computer science. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment, but I do need to take a quick break. So stay with us. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Good afternoon and welcome back. You are listening to The Georgene Rice Show. I'm continuing my conversation with Dr. Andy Walsh. He completed his postdoctoral fellowship at Carnegie Mellon University in computational biology, earned his PhD in molecular microbiology and immunology from Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. He serves as science writer for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's Emerging Scholars blog, and his writing can also be found, better way to put that, on the Pathos Network and in Behemoth, a Christianity Today publication. You point out in one of the parables that Jesus used, the parable of the sower, that he draws illustrations from botany, animal husbandry, microbiology, and that other biblical illustrations explore etymology, metallurgy, and astronomy. So I suppose we shouldn't be surprised by a book like yours that draws our attention to these different sciences that reveal something about who God is and helps us better understand him. You say the work of faith is to discern the meaning of what we observe in the world around us. Tell us a little bit about why that's the case.
One of the things to talk about, that comes from one of the earlier chapters in the book that talks about communication and information theory, which is a discipline in mathematics. And information theory talks about how we can quantify information, so we can figure out how many cell towers we need or how many phone lines we need to facilitate internet communications and cell phone communications and so forth. So that helps us to measure or quantify how much information we're dealing with. But what information theory can't tell us is what any of that information means. And in fact, you know, to put any kind of meaning into information or communication requires some sort of relationship. The folks on both ends of the communication have to agree on what that meaning is. And so I see one way to think about our Christian faith is agreeing with God that we want to find some common meaning in life and in his creation and in his word with him. We want to find the meaning that he is trying to communicate to us, and so we want to agree with God on that common meaning. And so part of our act of faith and our exploring what that faith really looks like in our lives is then trying to understand through the lens of Scripture and through the lens of Christian tradition, what's going on in the world around us, and how to understand it, and what it all really means, what the ultimate significance of it might be.
Who would you say is your target audience in writing about these four sciences?
Sure. So, you know, I'm hoping that the book will appeal not just to folks who are really invested in studying those sciences, who are in maybe scientific careers, but also folks who are fans of science fiction and other kinds of sort of more nerdy pop culture that are familiar with science or things that are sort of science adjacent, might be familiar with some of the terms that come up in science, and are interested then in learning more both about the science and about the Bible and seeing how those two might go together.
Well, in fact, you make quite a few references. I was a little intimidated because you knew a whole lot more about pop culture and like Gotham City and Batman and some of these figures, and somehow made them relevant and helped us to better understand some of the subjects that might otherwise have been certainly over my head, maybe not everyone else's. In your chapter, the part on the language of physics, you write about entropy, the many faces of entropy and its principle. What can we learn about God from the laws relating to entropy?
Sure. So entropy is the idea from physics that the universe, well, entropy is a measure of how energy is transformed and how useful energy is, the available energy in the system, how much usefulness we can get out of it. And there's a, you know, rule in physics or law in physics that the universe is tending towards using up its energy and leaving it all in a useless state, is sort of the tendency of all physical processes. And so another way to think about entropy and usefulness is that it provides actually provides a context in which life can exist. So as long as energy is in a low entropy state, in a useful state, then that's what's necessary for life to go on. And in our physical experience, the sun is sort of our ultimate source for all of that useful energy. The sun, because it is a very hot spot in the sky, because it's a very localized spot in the sky, not all around us, but just in one fixed point, that's what makes that energy that we get from the sun a low entropy energy that's useful for all of our life processes to go on. So we can kind of think of that as being a stand-in for God, that God is sort of the ultimate useful source of energy, the low entropy source of energy that makes our lives possible. And that, you know, in the act of becoming human, in the act of dying on the cross, God essentially gave up some of that low entropy state of himself so that the rest of us could live. This is the sun is sort of continually giving up its low entropy state so that life around in the physical world can persist. So that's one way to think about sort of that physics and how we relate to God and how God is providing life for us. And then also illustrates how we can think about how to be that for other people as well, that we can make sure that we are providing a useful source of energy to those around us and sort of balancing out things so that other folks can live and flourish and that we're not just storing up all of the useful energy for ourselves.
Now, the part of the book I think most of us will relate to perhaps most easily is the language of biology. We know that we are, as described in Scripture, fearfully and wonderfully made. But the detail, the genome made flesh, as you call that first chapter in that segment, helps us better understand in perhaps more significant ways how fearfully and wonderfully we are made and what that tells us about the nature of the God we worship.
Yeah, so that's actually building on one of these analogies in Scripture that I referenced and that you brought up earlier, that mm-hmm. You know, Scripture is already full of the language of science of its time. And, you know, Paul uses the illustration of the body and the different parts of the body as different parts of the church. And so I thought we could explore that a little bit further in the light of modern cell biology and thinking about each person in the church as an individual cell. And each cell in our bodies has an entire copy of our human genome. But at any given time, it's not expressing all of that genome. It's only expressing certain parts of it, depending on the kind of cell that it is, the history of it, of that cell and its ancestor cells, and the environment that it finds itself in, what sorts of cues it's getting from the cells around it currently and from things outside the body. And so in that same way, we can think about, well, each one of us has the Word of God in our lives. Each one of us has the entire Bible, hopefully has access to that as we participate in our church. But we're not all necessarily expressing the entire Bible all at once at any given moment. But it's really the whole church working together over time that expresses that whole genome of the church, which is the Bible or the Word of God.
Now, we're almost out of time, but I want you to comment on the part of the book, the language of computer science. That may be a bit more challenging for most of us. We think of the other sections as clearly the hand of God being expressed in his creation. Computer science, it's more difficult to see perhaps that relation. Talk a bit about how computer science helps reveal the glory of God.
Yeah, so computer science, as a discipline, you know, there's a couple different ways to think about it, but one of them is to think about it in terms of the algorithms that we write for computers, which is really just a fancy word for what are the processes or steps that we take to accomplish a particular task.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even before we had computers, we had to accomplish certain tasks, and we even had algorithms, even if we didn't necessarily call them that. And so, you know, there are certain steps that we take to accomplish various tasks, and even the Bible lays out different algorithms. You know, for example, the different sacrificial steps in the Old Testament, those are, you know, step-by-step process for how to relate to God, how to restore relationship with God when it's been broken, how to restore fellowship within the community when it's been broken. And so, we all have these procedures that we follow, and computer science is just a way to think a little bit more systematically about mm-hmm. them and to organize them into some more general principles. So that's what I talk about in those chapters of the book, is getting at some of those underlying principles and how we can use those to think about our practices in the Christian life of, fellowship, the spiritual disciplines of reading the Bible and praying and those sorts of things.
Well, this is really a fascinating book, and you've helped me to think about faith and science in ways that had not occurred to me. I would encourage those who are scientifically inclined and others who simply want to have a deeper faith and appreciate those disciplines, the sciences around us, and how they communicate the glory of God. Great book, Faith Across the Multiverse, Parables from Modern Science. Dr. Walsh, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Really appreciate it. By the way, the book is published by Hendrickson Publishers.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the second hour of the Georgene Rice Show. Well, as you know, we're all sheltering in place. That means events all across the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington have been canceled. Events where I would typically run into John Fortmeyer, because he is literally everywhere, covering for Christian News Northwest events that are of interest to the Christian community. He is the publisher, and as you probably know by now, the paper edition of Christian News Northwest has not been available since all of us were called upon to shelter in place in response to this pandemic. Well, the June issue of Christian News Northwest is now available online, but I wanted to check in with John to find out how things are going, and not only how they're moving now, but what the future might look like for Christian News Northwest. So, John Fortmeyer, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Georgine. It's awfully nice of you to check back in and see how we're doing. And I mean, all of us during this crazy time, it's good to check in with each other and see how things are holding up.
Yeah, you know, there are certain things that I just come to expect. I'm going to see John Fortmeyer, you know, a dozen times in the course of a year at various events, and I'm going to read Christian News Northwest when it's dropped off at the radio station. Well, neither of those things have been the case in the last couple of months. I'm so grateful that Christian News Northwest is available online. It's not the same, but you provide the same great, relevant, and timely information. Tell us a little bit about the online edition, and then I'd like to talk to you about the future of Christian News Northwest.
Sure. Well, I mean, you're right. It's not the same. I mean, at least from my perspective, Georgine, because I think I mentioned this before when we chatted, I literally have ink and newsprint in my veins. And to me, there's nothing quite like a newspaper. And online's good, and it's certainly readily accessible to anyone who has a computer or a smartphone or whatever. But there's just something about good old-fashioned newspapers that, let me put it this way. We have a wonderful network of folks who normally distribute the paper for us. You know, we, as I've mentioned before, for 26 years, we've been serving Western and Central Oregon and Southwest Washington. And in fact, this month is officially our 26th anniversary. We made a little note of that at the top of the page of our online edition here. We usually get the paper out to about 1,900 locations. And the folks who do that are just the most wonderful people you'd ever mm-hmm. want to meet. They share the vision for the newspaper and the mission that it serves, and they are just chomping at the bit to get back and distribute the thing. I've told them many times that even though I'm the publisher and editor of the paper, they're the ones that are really important, because they're the ones that physically get the paper out there, and they just want so badly to get out there and do it again, and I can't wait to be able to print. But we need to have a significant portion of those 1,900 locations reopen in order for that to happen. About 85% of our distribution normally is in churches. The rest are Christian schools, colleges and seminaries, libraries, bookstores, and some businesses. And as you know, 99% of those have been closed. I mean, they're just a very gradual reopening taking place right now.
Well, congratulations, first of all, in 26 years. That's a significant accomplishment. You know, as I think about the fact that Christian News Northwest relies heavily upon advertising, there are events that take place in our community, and they appear in the paper. As you think about our coming gradually back to normalcy or some form of it, what does that look like for Christian News Northwest? And are we likely to see this newspaper continue when we're looking back on this pandemic? fondly from a, you know, from a sufficient distance.
Well, that's certainly our deep aspiration, our goal. You know, we're like any, we're kind of half ministry and half business, and for it to be sustained, we need to have the income coming in. And I think last time we chatted, I mentioned that all newspapers, all of them, have been hit very hard with this situation. You know, before I started Christian News Northwest back in 1994, I worked for about 18 years for several quote-unquote secular newspaper companies in Washington and Oregon. And I never dreamed that I would see the day where those newspapers, either in the papers themselves or online, are openly advertising for donations to keep afloat. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just been that serious. You know, what is the immediate outlook? Well, I guess it depends on which commentator you hear talking on the news. You know, there's some economists that voice optimism that, I mean, it's pretty well conceded the second quarter of this year's not going to be good in terms of the numbers, but some economists will say that there's optimism to think that things will bounce back very strongly in the third quarter and even better in the fourth quarter. And certainly that would be helpful for all newspapers, including ours. What it would be especially helpful for us is when churches feel free to sponsor special events again, mm-hmm. because literally hundreds of events have been canceled within our circulation area through April, May, and June. And I was just on the phone today confirming what I expected, and that is some more cancellations of late summer. So what we hope and pray is that we do get a return to normalcy with that.
Now, as I read through Christian News Northwest online, and the June issue is currently available, I noticed there is a GoFundMe page. Can you explain how we can continue to support and help assure the future of Christian News Northwest, the print edition, moving forward?
Absolutely. If you go to our website, which is simply cnnw.com, right there at the very top, you will see where you can click on a couple of images there of currently of our May and June issues, and you can actually read those online issues there. But right next to that area is also a mention of a GoFundMe site that we set up when this whole pandemic broke out. Small businesses across the country were encouraged. It's kind of a joint promotion between QuickBooks and GoFundMe to set up GoFundMe sites to accept donations. And that's not anything that we had ever contemplated doing, but with the drop in advertising revenue, as serious as it was, I thought, well, maybe we should. And so I checked with our accountant to see if he thought it would be okay, and he said as long as we made clear that and newspapers that are accepting donations are doing this all over the place, we're not 501c3 operations under IRS law. In other words, we can't issue receipts for donation, tax receipts. But people still who don't mind not getting a tax receipt are more than welcome to make donations in that GoFundMe site. And if there's a link there on the homepage of our website, cnnw.com, to the GoFundMe page. It's called simply Support Christian News Northwest Newspaper. And it's been very gratifying. We've had, since we started that, we had $3,000 come in through that site, and we had another $1,000 in checks mailed to us. So that's been terrific.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, you can find all the details there at the site where you can read the June issue of Christian News Northwest, and that's simply cnnw.com. Well, John, I so appreciate that you are continuing to produce Christian News Northwest, and I look forward to holding that printed paper in my hands again. But in the meantime, I just want to encourage all of us to be supportive of Christian newspaper here in our community, And we'll try to keep in touch, and hopefully things will open up soon.
Thank you so much, Georgine. It's sure appreciated.
Thank you, John. Bye-bye. Hey, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back. And when we do, we'll talk about the Oregon update on COVID-19. The numbers are issued throughout the day, so we'll give you the latest as of this recording. So stay with us.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Taking a look at the latest numbers in Oregon, and keep in mind, we broadcast now. We record the program earlier, so we're not in real time. So these numbers may have changed since we received the last update. But one Oregon city woman has been battling COVID-19 for 2 months. We're being told she apparently is winning that battle, but it has been a harsh and very difficult challenge for she and her family. In Oregon, the death toll remains at 148. The number of cases, 3,967. That's overall for the 2 months that we have been sheltering in place and managing this pandemic. In Washington, the death toll, 1,078, and the number of cases, 20,181 cases thus far. In the United States, we stand at about 98,933. That's the latest U.S. numbers from earlier in the day. Well, as the Oregon City woman I mentioned earlier is on day 54 of her battle with the coronavirus, in addition to physical distress, she says she's felt depression and anxiety like never before. She found hope and community online, as many of us have, staying connected to one another as technology makes it possible. Well, parents, teachers, and school superintendents will find out in early June how schools are expected to function this fall after months of being closed. The director of the Oregon Department of Education, Colt Gill, said in an interview that the state expects school buildings to reopen in September. Well, that's good news. Mount Hood National Forest officials said most developed recreation sites will open on Friday. Some sites will remain closed, including most campgrounds and areas that are still under seasonal closure. The Oregon Employment Department says it has launched a project aimed at handling the 38,000 claim backlog that has continued to grow during the coronavirus pandemic. Well, that's good news. Meanwhile, two more churches in the state of Oregon are suing Governor Brown over the coronavirus restrictions. They're in Southern Oregon, and they filed lawsuit over her executive order banning large gatherings. It's the second lawsuit filed by churches against the governor. Last week, a judge in Baker County ruled the governor's coronavirus restrictions were null and void. But as you recall, the Oregon Supreme Court temporarily reinstated the restrictions until it could review the case. Alliance Defending Freedom filed the new lawsuit on Tuesday in federal court on behalf of Edgewater Christian Fellowship in Grants Pass and Roseburg Church of God Prophecy. The churches, which plan to resume in-person worship services this Sunday, fear their pastors and members could be fined and jailed for violating the governor's executive orders banning large gatherings. The pastor's attorneys argue it's not right for the pastors to be punished for going to church when they can gather with people at a dine-in restaurant and not fear being punished. And while responding to a crisis can be difficult, this crisis is not, says Caleb Dalton, an attorney for Alliance Defending Freedom, in a news release. There is no legitimate justification for banning church services of 26 or more with responsible social distancing and health and safety protocols, while allowing malls, gyms, restaurants, and retail establishments to fill to social distancing capacity. The lawsuit also argues that the governor's order violates the U.S. Constitution by prohibiting the free exercise of religion. It actually points to the free freedom to associate, but that's another matter. Meanwhile, California's Department of Health's reopening guidelines for houses of worship contain bitter news for those who love corporate worship. Strongly consider discontinuing singing, group recitation, and other practices and performances where there is increased likelihood for transmission from contaminated exhaled droplets, the report warns. In another section, it notes activities such as singing and group recitation negate the risk reduction achieved through 6 feet of physical distancing. Absorbing this is tough news for those who feel most connected to God and others through music. Of course, we can still engage in music wherever we happen to be, but when we're corporately together, they're suggesting that singing and group recitation is most guilty of spreading these exhaled droplets that spreads the virus. There's something about the articulating our emotional state and using music, using song as a means of expressing ourselves before the Lord. And that's deep in the Christian tradition, from singing and praying the Psalms to the early hymns in the New Testament, like in Luke's Gospel, and peppered through Paul's letters. There was also a reputation that early Christians get. In Pliny's letter to the emperor, he says, "These strange Christians get together before sunrise, and they sing these hymns to Christ as if to a god." Huh. Well, there's something about the song that helps us express more than just what the words of the song are saying. That's a quote from Mr. Packiam, who is also the author of the forthcoming book, Worship and the World to Come, Exploring Christian Hope in Contemporary Worship. He joined digital media producer Morgan Lee and editorial director Ted Olson to discuss how his church has handled the pandemic from a worship perspective, what makes corporate singing special, and what it means to that eschatology is missing from our worship music. You can find that conversation at Christianity.com online, and it's a rather interesting conversation, but it does point to the fact that corporate worship that involves singing together may have to be curtailed, or people may be required to wear masks, or some accommodation may need to be made, because that is one way that people are contracting the virus, or at least their aspirations, if you will, are have greater traction through singing. Hey, Salem Medium Group, as you know, is jumping into the movie business, streaming No Safe Spaces, the documentary about free speech with Adam Carolla and nationally syndicated radio host Dennis Prager. No Safe Spaces was one of 2019's top political documentaries, and it exposes the toll of political correctness on college campuses. Despite the film's popularity, the filmmakers weren't able to strike a deal with the traditional streamers because of political bias in Washington, so they took it to Salem Media. Salem has never done anything like this. Marketing the first time will show a feature film online. So the message of the film is how free speech and tolerance is being blocked by intolerant forces. And you can watch it. It'll make you laugh, cry, but think deeply as well. No Safe Spaces is now available to watch for limited time only at nosafespaces.com. And for KPDQ listeners, enjoy a 25% discount using the discount code SAVE25. That's nosafespaces.com, discount code SAVE25. Well, skyrocketing unemployment due to the coronavirus pandemic has been forcing a growing number of Americans to turn to charitable services for assistance as food insecurity among families with children is growing. Philanthropist and New York Mission Society board member Jean Shafroff mentioned how she's helping her community and raising awareness to help curb the growing numbers of food insecure Americans. The New York City Mission Society has been serving the city's most underserved children since 1812. And recently, it's been making food and utility baskets for the children it serves and delivering them during the pandemic. She says, "I can't tell you how desperately these food baskets are needed in the New York tri-state area. We have a very serious situation because so many residents live at or below the poverty level. The food pantries across the area are very helpful, but the supply and the demand are not working the way that they should right now. There is massive demand all over the country, 39 million Americans out of work, and this translates into no food on the table." Well, earlier in the week, I received an email from SnowCap, which is an organization in our own community, Oregon's largest provider of food assistance, and they're seeing a 26% increase in people in need, but not a commensurate increase in donations. SnowCap Community Charities remains open. They continue to serve those who need food during COVID-19, and reports show that East Multnomah County in particular has been hit the hardest, with the highest percentage of low-income families in Portland in the metro area. Well, as unemployment continues to rise here due to COVID-19, we're seeing a dramatic increase of families who never imagined they would need to ask for food, turning to SnowCap for assistance and other food pantries around the metro area. As demand grows, they need help. Tax-deductible gifts of non-perishable food and financial contribution will allow SnowCap and other organizations to continue being a reliable source to help those who find themselves making tough decisions for their families. Pre-COVID-19, SnowCap, singling out one group of, among many, served an average of 10,000 people a month through their shopping-style food pantry located in Rockwood. In response to COVID-19, they've converted the pantry operations into distribution for pre-packaged boxes of food from a protected walk-up window where people can come and get what they need. Well, among the things that SnowCap says they need most are canned vegetables and fruit, canned soups, chilies, tuna, egg cartons, bags, reusable paper or plastic bags, infant formula is on that list. Let me turn this alarm off. Is on that list, cloth masks and hygiene items. So as you are making sure that you and your family are well supplied with the things that you need, keep in mind that there are food pantries and charitable organizations in our community that have not stopped their efforts, and the needs of those they serve has only increased dramatically, while the folks who are supporting their efforts has decreased as dramatically. So keep in mind that there's a need and there are opportunities for us to give. Hey, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Wanted to mention that Multnomah County has held a press conference earlier in the day. Now, we were recording before that press conference was held, but apparently offered some updated information as to whether or not they're going to apply for phase one of reopening. You might want to check that out. We'll certainly cover it tomorrow in the program. While the Justice Department on Wednesday urged the president to veto legislation to reauthorize surveillance authorities used by the FBI just hours before a scheduled vote in the House, marking the latest curveball that puts the legislation in limbo, the Justice Department issued a statement today saying the legislation set to reauthorize and reform national security authorities in the USA Freedom Act goes too far and would weaken national security tools. If passed, the attorney general would recommend that the president veto the legislation, the statement from Assistant Attorney General Stephen Boyd said. Meanwhile, Richard Grenell has declassified a new batch of Russia probe documents on his way out as acting director of national intelligence, leaving the decision on whether to make those files public up to the newly sworn in director, John Ratcliffe. The documents include transcripts of phone calls that then incoming National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and then Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak had in December of 2016 during the presidential transition period. Grenell said publicly last week that he was in the process of declassifying those files after House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff asked him to do so. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Wednesday officially declared that Hong Kong is no longer autonomous from China, days after Beijing moved to impose new national security legislation on the territory. Beijing's disastrous decision is only the latest in a series of actions that fundamentally undermine Hong Kong's autonomy and freedoms and China's own promises to the Hong Kong people under the Sino-British Joint Declaration, a UN-filed international treaty, Pompeo said in a statement. Chinese government officials citing national security announced that the National People's Congress will review legislation that would criminalize anti-government movements like the recent years-long pro-democracy protests. Pro-democracy advocates say that such a move goes against the one country, two systems framework that promises freedoms to residents of Hong Kong not available to Chinese citizens on the mainland. That was set to expire, but certainly not this soon. Well, in February of 1970, Norma McCorvey, a pregnant street person, a 21-year-old woman in big trouble, writes McCorvey in her 1994 memoir, I Am Roe. I became Jane Roe at a corner table at Colombo's, an Italian restaurant, at Mockingbird Lane and Greenville Avenue in Dallas. That short meeting with Sarah Weddington and Linda Coffey, two lawyers looking for the right case to strike a blow on behalf of abortion rights, transformed McCorvey's life. The following month, Weddington and Coffey filed a lawsuit against Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade for enforcing Texas abortion laws and used McCorvey as their lead plaintiff. The case ended up in the United States Supreme Court, and on January the 22nd, 1973, the justices overturned the law 7-2 to legalize abortion in all 50 states. On that date, Norma McCorvey became Jane Roe of Roe v. Wade, part symbol, part person, trapped in a maelstrom of history and the sound and fury of America's abortion wars. When she left the abortion industry for the pro-life movement in 1994, she made headlines across the nation. Now again, McCorvey is making headlines as the bombshell subject of a new FX documentary, which I saw the night before last, a.k.a. Jane Roe, which claims that she changed her mind a second time and reverted back to a pro-abortion position. Producer Nick Sweeney tells a story in which McCorvey's relationship with the pro-life movement was strictly a financial one. In a series of interviews that she dubbed her deathbed confession, she calls it all an act. I was the big fish, she says in the documentary. I think it was a mutual thing. I took their money and they put me out in front of the cameras and tell me what to say. Well, numerous headlines have suggested that McCorvey was paid to change her mind on abortion, despite the fact that those are not actually her words, and trying to unearth the real narrative. One writer, Jonathan Van Maren, spoke with many of her close friends, three of whom went on the record. Those three, in addition to others, reject the idea that she was bribed into switching sides. So their story of McCorvey and their relationship with her is much more complex, intimate, and humane. For this new documentary to quote Norma saying that she was not genuinely pro-life is very suspicious, said Father Frank Pavone, director of Priests for Life. I knew Norma, her pro-life convictions were not an act. Well, I've seen the movie, and I have to say it was very discouraging to me, not for the pro-life movement in general, but for Norma McCorvey in particular, and the life she lived and how she moved and seemed to navigate from one side of the question to the other. And I was concerned about the state of her relationship with the church and her relationship with Christ. So for me, she's now since passed away. But there was an interesting piece in Christianity Today that goes into great detail among those who knew her in her latter days. And much of the documentary is her speaking in her own words. So you can't argue that they completely misconstrued what she was saying. But nonetheless, you may want to check that out. It's a deathbed apology. Norma McCorvey's pro-life friends tell another story. So if you're interested in looking more deeply into that controversy, Jonathan Van Maren is a public speaker, writer, and pro-life activist. His commentaries have appeared in a number of publications, but he writes about the life and legacy of Norma McCorvey and her relationship to the question of abortion on demand in the U.S. Meanwhile, Sue Ellen Browder, who wrote Fake News before fake news was ever a thing, except she prefers not to call it that, not because she's embarrassed to admit she wrote fake news, although she's certainly not proud, but because she thinks the term fake news is too vague to understand. According to her own confession, she says she wrote fake news for Cosmopolitan and now regrets misleading women on feminism. A Cosmopolitan magazine writer for 20 years, she describes what she wrote as propaganda. The goal, she says, to sell women on the idea that sexual liberation is the path to the single woman's personal fulfillment. Propaganda is very sophisticated, she tells the Daily Signal. It's a half-truth, selected truth, and truth out of context. Propaganda is used not to sell just products, she adds. It's also used to sell ideas. Prior to writing for Cosmopolitan, she worked at a small daily newspaper, the South Bay Daily Breeze, just outside Los Angeles. When she and her husband unexpectedly got pregnant, they were far more excited about it than her bosses at the newspaper were. They told me I could only work 5 months into the pregnancy and then I had to quit. That experience turned her, Browder, born and raised in small town Iowa, into a feminist, about which she wrote for many years. The year was 1969, and getting fired for being pregnant was a wake-up call. The situation made her, who, by the way, graduated from the Missouri School of Journalism, realize that women had quite a bit of work to do. Women could not apply for credit in their own name. They were there were help wanted ads, help wanted male, and help wanted female, she says. Women had very few options available to them, but she now, in reflection, says that she wrote propaganda for Cosmopolitan magazine and now regrets the misleading content of that that writing over a span of 20 years. You can find that at thedailysignal.com, more on this Cosmopolitan writer who, in her book in 2015, Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement, documents the disgust of many pro-life feminists. But from that point on, the narrative was set. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back to wrap things up.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. This is the final segment of The Georgine Rice Show. During the pre-taping of this program, we just got the latest numbers for the state of Oregon. No new deaths in Oregon, 71 new cases, 41 of which are in Multnomah County, which is rather interesting considering that Multnomah County is going to update the public on reopening plans. In fact, did so in the future from our recording standpoint, but in the past from your listening standpoint. The Multnomah County is the only county remaining in the state of Oregon that has not yet applied to enter phase one of the governor's reopening plan. So it will be interesting to learn what that will look like and whether or not Multnomah County leaders are going to move forward in the short term or, given these latest numbers, if that's likely to be lengthening the time between that request being made. Again, no new deaths in the state of Oregon, 71 cases, however, across the state, 41 of which are in Multnomah County. Well, Americans are pretty highly concerned about the coronavirus, even as parts of the country start to reopen. And while the root cause of these concerns, you know, they come from various sources, polling indicates that a slightly higher percentage of Americans fear the economic effect of a prolonged period of quarantine. Now, that's not at all surprising at 49%, since a significant number of us have been either laid off, furloughed, or some other way of our income being reduced. Then the health threat posed by the virus at 45%. The fact remains, Americans are afraid. A certain level of anxiety is understandable. We live in challenging times in which concerns about rising unemployment, access to health care, and the possibility of an economic recession dominate the headlines. Loved ones are losing jobs, small businesses are struggling, churches are having to reevaluate how they do ministry, and of course there are those whose lives are being lost. In this context, fear is a natural human reaction. David Clawson points out that Christians need to think very carefully about the current moment and the important conversations taking place around us. In the weeks ahead, those in authority ought to be guided by the principles of neighbor love and ensure that all their decisions honor the inherent dignity of everyone made in God's image. Christian doctors, businessmen, policymakers should prayerfully consider how to balance the reopening of the country with protecting the health of those Americans in the country. Well, unfortunately, there are always those who try to exploit a crisis by further stirring up fear. There have already been examples of state and local authorities using the current situation as an opportunity to amass more power to themselves. However, Christians must recognize the dangers of allowing fear to drive the national response. We should caution our friends and neighbors about the hazards of an alarmist mentality that could ultimately lead to the government assuming excessive power. Such conditions have historically led to the suspension of civil liberties. The government has a vital role to play in addressing the crisis, to be sure. However, fear-driven people placing all their trust in government is highly dangerous. That's why Christians must be vigilant and ensure they're being guided by faith in the principles of God's word rather than fear. I found it interesting that the CDC just days ago said we're now issuing new guidelines with regard to surfaces. The virus doesn't linger on surfaces as we had just thought. And then today I read again that they're concerned that the virus on surfaces may linger longer than their earlier directive. So not even science is giving us reliable certainty when it comes to this virus. The Bible frequently addresses the topic of fear. For instance, Joshua 1:9 says, "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened and do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." And despite facing many harrowing situations in his personal and public life, David believed that following followers of God should not be ruled by fear. In the 27th Psalm, first verse, he wrote, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" Likewise, the Apostle Paul rejected fear, reminding his young ministry partner, "For God gave us a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control," in 2 Timothy, the first chapter. Remarkably, every genre contained in the Bible, historical narrative, epistle, poetry, and prophecy, features admonitions to not be afraid. Why does the Bible say so much about fear? Well, humanity's natural inclination to fear is a result of living in a fallen world where we are estranged from our Creator. Even Christians who've been reconciled to God through faith in the person and work of Jesus are still affected by sin, and as a result, they don't yet experience full peace and assurance. Unfortunately, we are often consumed with our own struggles and circumstances, and when the concerns of this fallen world press in on us, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. When this happens, even the most faithful Christians are often tempted to act on fear and to seek help in the wrong places. The consistent message of Scripture, however, is a reminder of God's people that no matter how difficult our trials become, we must keep our eyes fixed on God. We must trust him to work even difficult situations for his glory and our good. Notably, when God tells his people not to fear, he usually provides a reason why they shouldn't be fearful. Namely, he reminds us He reminds them of his presence. For example, immediately after instructing Joshua not to be dismayed, he adds, "For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." Joshua 1:9. It's important for us to remember, like Elisha's servant, who often needed to be reminded that no matter how dire the situation appears to be, those who are with us are more than those who are with them. 2 Kings, 6th chapter. In the coming weeks, Christians have an incredible opportunity to model what sincere trust in God looks like. And although Christians are facing the same challenges as everyone else, we can have peace and confidence that surpasses all understanding if we stay rooted in the character and the promises of God. And hopefully, when we look back on these times in the months and years to come, we'll be able to see God's good hand of providence and how these difficult days produced opportunities for gospel advancement that would have been impossible any other way. So let's choose faith over fear and trust God to preserve and keep us as we lean on Him in these very difficult and trying days. As the governor, as county officials and others are grappling with what rules to keep in place, which ones to lift, and how to move back in toward normalcy, although it will be a new normal that we settle on, at least in the near term, let's pray for those governing authorities that they would act in wisdom and have discernment, that they would not act out of self-interest, but they would do what is right based on what they know, and what they don't know, that they would recognize their need for a higher authority and perhaps press into seeking wisdom from above. What a tremendous opportunity we have been given as we shelter in God. And that's what I hope all of us are doing in these challenging days. Well, tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk with some friends at Child Evangelism Fellowship. They have some resources available to families to help them help them navigate these difficult times. So I hope you'll join us for that. I also want to thank James Blend for producing, Clark Hilton for engineering, Dan Rice for the use of his office for today's program. And thank you for making the Georgene Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.